All right, so today we are going to be starting with, last week we talked a bit about chapter 12 and we talked about how that's like a song of victory, you know, how each of the kings are listed there, and that's a song of victory. So today we are going to start, 31 kings are listed. Later on in our study, we're going to discuss one of the kings that you would expect to be that is not there. But we'll leave that for another time. So today we're starting with chapter 13. And this chapter begins that Joshua is getting old, okay? And God speaks to him and says, you're old. So not only do we know he's old, but God says to him, you're old, okay? But there's still a lot of land left to be inherited. Okay, and one of the things that is very important to understand here is there's no question that with the completion of the two big battles against the Northern Coalition, against the Southern Coalition, it is the nation of Israel that controls the land as a whole, okay? But what has happened is there's certain parts of the land that are left out, that we can say two main regions are not conquered at all. And they will remain not conquered for most of the biblical history. One of them will be. I'll show you a map of that in a minute. But what we have in addition is a lot of cities and pockets within the area that they've conquered that remains Canaanite. And this is the main challenge. This is the main issue that they will face later on. Okay, so let's go and take a look quickly at what we're talking about. In verses 2 through 7, we have the area of the Philistine and the Geshuri. And then later on, we have in that entire area of what we know as the Philistine area. Let me share with you. All right, so this again, we have this map that is in Hebrew. But you don't really need to read the names. Let me explain. So first of all, let me just give you the perspective. You see the map of Israel. You see here the Dead Sea. You see the Jordan River. Here's the Sea of Galilee, a bit of the Jordan above. Okay. This area here that's kind of shaded pink, this is one of the areas that's considered the land that has remained. And it's the area that is mentioned, I kind of went backwards, but it's mentioned starting in verse 4, and it goes up to the area of Sidon. This is Sidon, we know is the actual city of Sidon is right here. This is a city in Lebanon, okay? This whole area, though, was considered the area of the Sidonites, or I don't know how you say that in English, but, you know, this was their area, and that of course was not conquered and was really never conquered, although there was a brief period where Solomon had some business up there. Okay, and then we have on the eastern edge of this, it includes the Hermon, which you can see mentioned in verse 5. Okay, the Lebanon, the Givli, the eastern area from Baal Gad under the mountain of Hermon. Okay, so this is the area here. This is the whole area. We have the Hermon here as we know it today. Now, let's talk about modern Israel. This area down here is the area that is referred in biblical times as the Bashan, and that is the area that is the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights today goes a little bit further north of there, okay? But this is Damascus, okay? So with the exception of the Yom Kippur War, where we ended up being 25 kilometers just outside of Damascus, other than that, Israel has never controlled Damascus. So basically, Israel as we know it today also does not include this area up here. It includes this part of the Golan. This is what you would call the Syrian Golan up here. And this area here is the Israeli Golan as we know it today. And that's what's referred to biblically as the Bashan. So that was not captured. Now let's go to the southern part. That's 1 second. Okay. And here we have the Philistines. Area here is an entire area that's the Philistines. And that we have mentioned starting in verse 2. Okay. All the cities of the Philistines. And we have the five cities of the Philistines actually mentioned by their rulers in verse, what verse is this? In verse 3, okay, we have the five areas. We have Gaza, which is here, okay? We have, you'll recognize every single one of these names is a city in Israel today. Okay, that's, I find incredibly interesting. Okay, so this is Gaza. This is Ashkelon. This is Ashdod. This is Gat over here. And, oh, Ekron. Now, Ekron, there is a place called Kiryat Ekron. This is where it is biblically. I'm not sure if that's where it is in modern Israel. But anyway, this is the area of the Philistines, the three cities over here close to the coast, and then two further east, Ekron and Gat. Okay. Now, when we talk about Gaza, we talk about the Gaza Strip of today. Ashdod and Ashkelon are in Israel. Starting about here is where the Gaza Strip is. And of course, it includes the city of Gaza, and it comes down till about here, where's the border of Egypt. This city, this line here, this river is the El Arish River. And many people believe that when the biblical boundaries were given that to the river of Egypt, it referred to this, although many believe that the river in Egypt refers to the Nile, okay? In any case, this area here in green is the area that might be the area of the Geshur. It's not clear. The Geshur might be down here, and the Geshur might be up here, up there in the Golan. Either case, these are the two main areas that are not count. One second, how do I see everybody? I'm not seeing everybody. Here we go. Okay, these are the two areas. Ah, we'll get there. Second, here we go. These are the two areas that have not been conquered. And, however, and I'm gonna show this, you see up here these all these little cities that are with a circle and a red dot inside, those are noting circles that are, even though the entire area has been captured by the Israelites, these particular cities remain Canaanite, bubbles or whatever, you know, enclaves that remain inside, that have not been captured, but they're within the area, the overall area that, yes, was captured by the Israelites. Okay, and now we see in verse 7, God is still speaking to Joshua, and he says, you know, divide this land, divide it into an inheritance for 9.5 tribes, 9 tribes plus half of the tribe of Manasseh. Why is that? And it's going to go on to explain that already in Moses's time, this whole area, the eastern edge of the eastern side of the Jordan, was already divided between Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. It's very interesting. Manasseh on this side is like here, okay? And on this side is about here. So if you see the map of the tribe, Manasseh kind of crosses the Jordan with one half to the east and one half to the west. But this is the basic area where we see the tribe of the 2.5 tribes that were divided already by Moses. And this is just repeating that. Okay, now I want to stop the share. Okay, good, back. Okay, so that really takes us through verse 13. And then in verse 14, we have, but the tribe of Levi did not get a territory because it is, and here it's very interesting. We have two very, very similar similar verses, a slight difference. Verse 14 says only the tribe of Levi did not receive a territory. The sacrifices to the Lord God of Israel, that is its territory, as we have spoken to him. So this makes it sound as if basically their territory, their source of income almost, is the fact that in service to God, they receive parts of the sacrifices, and that is how they will live. We see a few verses later in verse 33, We have almost the same verse, except here it doesn't talk about the sacrifices. It just talks about that God is their territory. And I think both of these verses kind of complement one another. On the one hand, there's no question, they don't have territory. And that means in an agricultural society, they don't have a source of income. So the first verse solves the income problem. It says, oh, they don't have a territory, but don't worry. Through, and we know this already from the five books of Moses and all the rules that are in, particularly in Leviticus, we know that there are certain gifts, certain parts of the sacrifice and other gifts, you know, a tenth, a tithing of all the produce, etc. This goes to the Levites. And so this becomes how they live. But in the second verse, at the end of the chapter, in verse 33, I see that as being a much more ideological kind of statement. It's not worrying about how they're going to live, but it's saying they have their own territory in a very unique way. They are not bound to the land. They are bound to God. And this kind of puts them above any particular physical territory, because what's important to the Levites is their relationship with God. They're not tied to the land. And in fact, in the Jewish tradition, it is the Levites who became the teachers. Now, we know that the Levites had roles and jobs in the temple, but what they did, they took turns. I mean, not all the tribe of Levi was in the temple at any one time. There was a rotation, and they had a 1 week or 2 week stint, and then the rest of the time, they were not in the temple. So what did the Levites do the rest of the time? And under Jewish tradition, what they were doing was teaching. They were responsible for the spiritual welfare of the nation. And they traveled around and they taught and they made sure that the Israelites knew what they were supposed to be doing, how to behave, how to fulfill the commandments, etc. And then I just reach over my, you can see that this is actually seen to be a fulfillment in the blessing that that Jacob gives to his sons. This is going back to Genesis chapter 49. He says, in fact, it's coming out of anger. He is criticizing Simeon and Levi for their acts of rashness and violence in the way they handled the rape of their sister Dinah. And so in verse 7, this is Genesis chapter 49, verse 7, Jacob says he's cursing their anger, okay? And he's saying as a result, at the end of this, he says, I will divide them up within Jacob and I will disperse them amongst Israel. And so this idea of the Levites not getting a territory is seen also to be a result of this blessing or curse or whatever that Jacob gives to the tribe of Levi. And actually, if you look at it, Levi and Simeon, Simeon actually, and in this time, they're going to be getting a territory. They really don't get their own territory. Simeon ends up being swallowed up by Judah. Simeon just becomes part of the territory of Judah. So they don't have their own. Whereas Levi gets no territory and instead is literally spread out over the land as teachers, as travelers. And we all know as well that there's going to be, we'll see this also later, cities set aside for the Levites and the priests, and those are all over the place. Okay, so again, this is something that's unique to Levi, but also I think it's very interesting how Jewish tradition gives them a role that's very important, that they need to be spread out so that they can be teaching and be the spiritual guides for the entire nation. Okay. Then moving on in chapter 13, between starting in verse 15, we start seeing a, more or less a repeat about the borders of Reuben and Gad. And this is exactly what was already done before by Moses. Okay. And that we know takes that. And we see that in verse 32. This is the area in the plains of Moab that was set aside for these tribes, for those two and a half tribes. Okay, and that brings us to the end of the chapter. Now I want to go on to chapter 14. First of all, one of the things I do want to say about this what begins with God saying about the land that is left yet to conquer, there is a certain, there's a level perhaps of criticism, certainly a level of urging on. Okay, the job is not done. We have on the one hand that Joshua is old, and yet on the other hand, there's a job left to be done. But we don't have a continuation to that idea, other than the fact that Joshua does continue to at least divide some of the land at this point. We don't have a whole lot of continuation for that until later on, but we'll do that later. Okay, so chapter 14, it continues. Here we have the rest of the nation, and this is really how they divide the land to the 9.5. They divide the land by a lottery, okay? And we believe that the lottery is based on a divine direction, okay? It's not just how it comes up, but what they find is you know, as the lottery comes up, and it could very well be that this was by communication by God via the breastplate of the high priest that would indicate him, this is the area that's for this tribe, this is the area for that tribe. And we then have a lot of, we have again, a lot of boundaries. And we learned that, for example, the sons of Joseph have two different tribes. That's two tribes, it's Ephraim and Manasseh. And we have that. Now I'd like to focus on this little story that begins in verse 6. I find it a very important story and I want to really focus on it now. Okay, you know what I need? I need my English Bible so I can read it better to you. I have about 3 or 4 different Bibles going here, so I just move between them. Some have commentary, some have English, some have all different stuff. So I'm going to make sure I have the English one so I can read it in a more accurate way. Okay, so Joshua chapter 14, verse 6. The people of Judah, the sons of Judah, approached Joshua at Gilgal. Okay, so first of all, what are we talking about here? Gilgal is the camp where all of the nation is residing during the time of the wars. So what we're learning here is, even though we have a sense that the wars are over, and they're now dividing up everything they've conquered, except for these little pockets of things they haven't conquered, yet the nation is still sitting in Gilgal, okay? That's going to be significant later, but I want to point that out here. Okay, so Caleb, who is, of course, from the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, he approaches Joshua, "You know what instructions the Lord gave at Kadesh Barnea to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me." Now, Caleb and Joshua, these guys were partners. What happened in Kadesh Barnea? This is where Moses sent the 12 spies into Israel in the second year from the exit from Egypt. Okay, now it was already the end of the first year. We're in the second year when this happens, and they're about to go into the land, okay? And then what happens? They send these people to spies. And of course, we know that Caleb and Joshua became a team. They were the only ones that came back with a worthy report. The 10 others came back with a bad report, and all of those 10 did not come into the land. Of that group, only Joshua and Caleb comes into the land. And now he talks about this. "I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I gave him a forthright report. While my companions who went up with me took the heart out of the people, I was loyal to the Lord my God." It's very interesting. He speaks about himself, but he knows darn well Joshua was with him in this thing. But of course, remember, today they're in two different positions. Then they were equals and partners. But in the meantime, Joshua's become a leader. So he can't just say, "Remember, you and I were buddies." He talks about himself because it's, you know, he has to indicate respect to the leader. But clearly, he's saying, "You know, you remember," as a whiff of saying, "You know, you and I then were buddies." Okay. "On that day, Moses promised on oath, 'The land on which your foot trod shall be a portion for you and your descendants forever, because you were loyal to the Lord your God.' Now the Lord has preserved me, as he promised. It is 45 years since the Lord made this promise to Moses when Israel was journeying through the wilderness, and here I am today, 85 years old. I am still as strong today as on the day that Moses sent me. That's pretty good, by the way. How many people can you say are as strong at 85 as they were at 40? But okay. I am still as strong today as on the day that Moses sent me. My strength is the same now as it was then, for battle and for activity. So assign to me this hill country as the Lord promised on that day. Though you too heard on that day that Anakites are there and great fortified cities, if only the Lord is with me, I will dispossess them as the Lord promised. Okay, until now, we have no idea what place he's talking about. He says it's a hill place, and it's a place that has giants, okay? And he also happens to mention, don't worry, I know the giants are still there. I'll take care of it. You assign me that area, I'll clear out the giants. This connects very much with this idea of the remaining territories. Remaining territories, even though we know already they conquered the south, they conquered Hebron. We read about that in the previous chapters. What he's saying here is, but we haven't really cleared out everybody yet. There's still pockets of people, and in this case, the giants, don't worry, I will clear them out. And so this gives us a perfect illustration of what really are we talking about. When we have the remaining land, for the most part, we're talking about these little pockets. We are not looking at going into major wars. The major wars are over, but in order to actually settle something, sometimes you have to go out and clear an area, make it your own by actually settling it. And that's what we're talking about here, okay? But again, we don't know what the place is. And here in verse 13, we're going to find out what the place is. So Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and assigned Hebron to him as a portion. Ah, that's what we're talking about, Hebron. Thus Hebron became the portion of Caleb, son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, as it still is, because he was loyal to the Lord, the God of Israel. The name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba. Arba was the great man among the giants, and the land had rest from war. Okay, so first of all, this last verse, the land had rest from war, tells us that this whole encounter took place after the wars are over. All right, so there's two things that we can learn from this little section. First of all, our Jewish commentaries already from ancient times put a time frame on the actual capture and settlement of the land, okay? And it comes from these verses. See what it says. It says that Caleb was 40 years old when he went forward. It was 2 years after the Exodus from Egypt. So if he was 40 years, if it was 2 years from, and they spent a total of 40 years in the desert, they actually spent 38 years after the sin of the spies. So 40 plus 38, okay? That means at the point at which they entered the land, they crossed the Jordan River and entered the land, that would have made Caleb 78 years old, okay? In other words, at the start of the conquest, of the wars to conquer the land, Caleb would have been 78. He would have been 40 plus 38 of the year. He was 40 years old, and then an additional 38 years from the time of the spies until they entered the land of Israel, 78. We learn then in this verse here in verse 10 that he's 85 years old at this point of time when he's approaching Joshua and asking for Hebron. And we learn at the end of verse 15 that this is the end of the wars. From that, we have from 78 to 85 is 7 years. So as a result of this, Jewish commentaries say that the entire process of war to capture the land took 7 years, okay? Now, they therefore say that the period of time, and again, we're going to see this in the continuation of this, the difference between the big wars of conquest and the settlement. Now, is the settlement just a question of moving, packing your bags and moving into a place? If that were the case, it would take a month. You've all moved house, right? And you've had houses and you've had to, you know, do all kinds of stuff. But imagine you're living in a tent in the Gilgal. How many possessions can you possibly have? Maybe you'll fold up your tent, you put a few things together, you get on your donkeys or whatever, and you go you know, you cross back over the Jordan, and how long do you think it'll take to go from the Jordan to, I don't know, even the furthest place up in the Galilee? Maybe it'll take 3 days. Okay. So you could safely say, given all the arrangements and when maybe you have to gather your food and water and whatever, it's a month. Okay. If all settlement is moving to the new place, it's a month. No, settlement is not that. Settlement is actually laying claim to the land in a physical way. And this is very important. I find this very important discussion when we talk about Israel today. And there's no, I'm not using the word settlement by accident, because in the Hebrew, the word used for the second 7 years is settlement. And it's the exact same word in Hebrew we use today when we talk about the settlements. It's from the word nachala, which means territory. And in Hebrew, a settlement or the period of settlement is called hit nachalut, settling. Why? Because settling is not just about moving into a new house. It's not even about pitching your tent or building your new house. It's about laying claim to the land. And that took the extra 7 years. Took the extra 7 years to go to a place and make sure it was safe, to make sure that all these people that were still around, you know, either were at peace with us or got out of the way. Okay. In some cases, as we saw on that map, there were cities that were still Canaanite cities sitting in the middle of the area. Okay. Some of those, they solved the problem. Some of those, they didn't. What we learn from what's going on here and Caleb's discussion, he talks about what he knows in order. He wants Joshua to give him Hebron. They've already conquered Hebron. And yet he says to him, I know there's already giants there that I'm going to have to take care of. This is the process of settlement, of going into Hebron, saying it's mine, getting rid of the giants, building a city, all of that becomes settlement. And so our sages say that they see it as a parallel. In the same way that there were 7 years for the conquest, it's a 7 year for the settlement. Now, there is also another way that they come to that. It's an incredibly complicated mathematical thing having to do with what Ezekiel says about the number of years that the first temple stood. I'm telling you, I read it. I said, I'm not going to bother you with that. If you want to accept the 7 years of settlement, you can, you don't have to, but I do. There's no question that there's an equal process going on of settlement after the actual conquest. And so that's what we're seeing here. The second thing that I want to point out that we see in this chapter here, in this issue, is when he says that what he talks about Moses' promise to him. And he says, this is going back to verse 9. The land on which your foot trod shall be a portion for you and your descendants forever. What place did Caleb trod that nobody else trod? Okay, now some of you may have heard me do this teaching before. I very often do this when I'm taking groups to Hebron, but let me point this out to you, okay? Numbers, the book of Numbers, verse 13, this is where we actually see the story of the spies, okay? And we look at verse 22. This is the beginning. They leave Israel. They leave the desert. They go up, verse 21. They went up and scouted the land for the wilderness of Tzin to Rehov at Levo Hamat. Okay, now 22. Here we are going to have a difference, I guarantee you, between the Hebrew and the English. And this is one of the things I found that was so fascinating. It's one of the first times that I discovered, maybe even discussing with you, Kim, where I discovered that the English translation was wrong and therefore you've missed the whole point because if you're only seeing it in English, okay? The English says as follows, they went up to the Negev and came to Hebron. Okay, sounds like everybody together, all 12 spies went up to the Negev and came to Hebron until you look at the Hebrew. The Hebrew says they went up to the Negev and he came to Hebron. He, it changes from plural to singular. The coming to Hebron is written in the original Hebrew as he, one person. Now, I understand why the English did it, because you look and say, he, that doesn't make sense. They're all of them. They come out. So they just, you know, were sloppy and said, okay, and came up to Hebron. Well, it's wrong. It's just wrong. Okay. Who came up to Hebron? The answer is in Joshua 14. Because here, Caleb says to Joshua, the place where I put my foot, that is, well, the promise from Moses is the land on which your foot trod. And later on, when he's cashing in on that promise, we find out that where is that place? Hebron. So what happened was all 12 of them went up in the Negev. Caleb by himself detoured. He went to Hebron. Okay. And by the way, in that same verse, we talk about these same giants. Okay. Look at back at Numbers 13, verse 22. And he came to Hebron where lived Achiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the giants. Okay. And we're going to find those same giants here as well. So Hebron still has those giants. It sounds to me like they live long lives, but not necessarily, because Caleb was there then and Caleb is there now, and the same giants are still there. They are still there. But anyway, this is very interesting. It is only Caleb that goes. Now, there's a beautiful midrash that talks about what it is that Caleb was doing by himself in Hebron. Why was he there? Now, of course, you well know that Hebron is the place of the tomb of the patriarchs. And that is where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were buried. And this, of course, I'm sure was well known. Certainly there was this tradition that had been passed down. Maybe even there was a marker on the place. I don't know. But the tradition that we have, the Midrash says that Caleb detoured to go to Hebron, praying there at the tomb of the patriarchs, asking God to give him wisdom and guidance to be successful in this mission. And reminding God, remember who's buried here. Here is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, our forefathers that you promised this land to. Here we are back in the land as part of the process to begin fulfilling that promise. He says, please, God, make my mission successful so we can move forward in fulfillment of your promise to our forefathers who are buried here. I think this is such a beautiful, beautiful midrash. First of all, it shows us that Caleb already knew who he was out there. He knew that there might be trouble and he needed extra help, extra prayer. He needed to have that extra prayer to pray for the success of this mission, not just that they wouldn't get captured, but it was a much more spiritual kind of success. Enable this mission to go forward so that it actually serves the fulfillment of God's promise to our forefathers. And I think also though, it gives us this amazing sense of continuity. Okay, the Hebron of our forefathers is the same Hebron that Caleb is so eager to have, okay? And it's so important to him. And he knows it's not, I don't believe he wants Hebron because, well, if the giants were there, it must be a well-fortified city or something like that. You know, he wants Hebron because he knows Hebron is special. He knows Hebron because he wants Hebron because he wants to be in that very place where our forefathers are buried and where our forefathers lived. I mean, they're buried there because they lived there. And of course, as we all know, Hebron was really the first city where our forefathers settled. And so I like to think of it as the first Jewish city in the world. It was the first place that our forefathers settled and lay claim to. And so it was so significant for Caleb to settle and lay claim to it too. And here we go. Here we see for the first time, and I don't know, I'm sure all of you share my sense of, how important Hebron is to us today. And there's so many people that say, oh, Hebron, Arabs, what are you there for? You know, it's not just there for historical reasons. It's not just that I can say, what do you mean Hebron is Jewish? And I can point to thousands of years of Jewish possession and settlement in Hebron. But there's something that Caleb understood that I think we understand as well. Hebron is just not another city. It's a special city. And it was something he wanted and it's something we want. And if we learn anything also from Joshua, it's not enough to have conquered the place. You have to settle it, because only through settlement can you really make it your own. That's all for today. Anyone have questions? Turn on your mics. Happy to hear you guys.
If anyone is interested, I did a whole teaching kind of based on this, because I really felt like the Lord showed me that, you know, when Caleb went to Hebron, why would he go to Hebron? And I think that he really went to Hebron to pray and to remember. And God showed him the original covenant that he had made with Abraham And that played very much into why Caleb was one of the two that came back with a good report, because he really sought God and he really sought God's promises. And God just showed him, you know, the plan. And so even though there were giants in the land and even though there was so much to overcome, he still came back and said, "We're well able. Let's go up and take it today."
Right. That's great.
I have a question.
Sure.
Jacob was buried at Shechem. Yes.
Jacob, no. Jacob is buried in Hebron. He's in the tomb of the patriarchs. Joseph's body, Joseph's bones were buried in Shechem. Yes.
Yes. Why?
Why?
Okay. Why was he taken up there?
First of all, he wanted to be. He said, he gives the instruction at the very end of Genesis. And I'll find
bury my bones up.
You know, don't forget, he was like a king of Egypt. And so when he died, he was, I assume, mummified or whatever he was buried in Egypt as a king. Jacob had the ability, they had the ability to say, Jacob really wants to go back and be buried in Egypt. Joseph didn't have that ability. I mean, the pharaohs would not have tolerated somebody that had an important position in Egypt not to be buried in Egypt. So what he does is he says to his brothers before he dies, he says, remember, this is Genesis 50, verse 24, he says, there'll come a time, okay, that God will remember you. Okay, and he will take you out of this land to the land that was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made his brothers swear to the children of Israel, saying, the Lord will remember you, and you will take out my bones from here. Okay, so the fact that he was buried in the land of Israel came from his own wish. Why was he buried in Shechem? Shechem was in the territory of Joseph. Okay, and this was Shechem is actually in the territory of Ephraim, which actually it's already further north of most of Ephraim. It kind of Ephraim goes up to include Shechem, but it's right next to Manasseh. So it's in this area that's really on the border between Ephraim and Manasseh. So it's an area that covers both of his children, and it's just a logical place for him to be buried. Okay. Now, there is a tradition that says he's actually buried in the place where Jacob bought land. Okay, when Jacob first came back, and I'll give you the source of that as well. When Jacob first came back from Haran, he came to the area of Shechem and he bought some land there. Where is it? One second. Here we go. In Genesis chapter 33, verse 19, and he bought the area of land where he had placed his tent from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 coins or silver pieces or whatever. Okay, so he bought a territory of land from this family that ruled Shechem. So it was a piece of land in or outside of Shechem. Okay. And our tradition is that is where Joseph was buried, in that original piece of land that his father had purchased on his way back from Haran.
Because I was trying to place whether that was purchased or not. And you just answered that.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you.
Have time for another question?
Sure.
This has to do with the timeline. If you could put a date, approximate date, and let me know about how long the land was continuously occupied until perhaps the exile to Babylon. How many hundreds of years?
Well, okay. So if we're talking about, again, that's part of those calculations that I said that made me a little bit leery. but it's, I think 400, I think the first temple stood for, if I'm not mistaken, 420 years. And then if we go backwards 420 years, David was king for 40 years, okay? And Solomon built the temple very shortly after becoming king. And then prior to that, that takes us with to David. Prior to that, well, Saul did not rule for that many years. I don't remember.
40 years?
40 years?
40?
I think it's less than 40.
So between Saul. Caleb and...
Well, wait, then there's this whole time.
With the judges.
The tabernacle at Shiloh, which is established sometime during the sometime after the 7 years of conquest, during the period of settlement, okay? Mm-hmm. The tabernacle of Shiloh is established, and that goes for 9 years, okay? So we figure add 7, that's 370-something years. Figure it's like 400 years from the entrance of the land until the, until, let's say, Saul, okay? And let's say Saul until... the temple being built is another, let's say, 50 years or so. So that's 400 and 450 and another 420. So we're talking about over 800 years from the time of entering the land until the exile to Babylon.
Mm, great. Good. Okay. Thank you.
Something like that. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, it was great to see you all, and I hope to see you next week.